Members, I will call the Health and Human Services Reform Committee meeting to order. And we do have a quorum present, members. So our first order of business will be to move the minutes for February 24th. Do I have anyone who wants to move those minutes? Representative Peterson moves the minutes of February 24th. Any objection to that, members? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Members, today we are going to be discussing our public programs relative to Mincher and some of the changes and challenges that our counties are dealing with, and particularly focusing on one of the OLA reports that came out last fall, but we as a committee haven't had a chance to go over it. And members do have a copy of that report in the packets. And so we are first going to be hearing from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on the work that they did. After that, we will be hearing from some representatives of the counties in terms of what the implementation of Mincher has meant for them and the enrollment into public programs. And then we will also be hearing from the Department of Human Services slash Mincher. We're kind of one in the same when we're talking about public programs. And then at the end, members, we will open it up for questions. So we are going to go through, each group is going to have about 20 minutes, give or take, and then save questions at the end. And just also wanted to make reference that the report and PowerPoint is on the committee website, just for the audience's information or if anybody's listening. So with that, we will get started with today's business. And so I will turn it over to the Office of Legislative Auditor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor. And with me at the table is Cecile Perkel, who is the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for having us. I know some of you heard our report last week on Mincher. And if you did, you know that we emphasized very strongly that Mincher did not deliver what was promised, what was expected, and what was needed. And one of the reasons we came to that conclusion was that it did not deliver what we need very badly in terms of a modernized, fully functional, fully reliable eligibility determination system for our public programs. That's something that we have been seeking in this state for over a decade and have spent a lot of money trying to obtain. It is something we tried to obtain with Health Match. That didn't work. And so then the plan was to take this opportunity to implement the ACA with a modernization of our system of eligibility determination for public programs. I think that Mincher got us closer, but we're still not there. Based on the work we've done, Mincher does not provide us with a fully functional, fully reliable way of determining eligibility for our public programs. And it is vital, absolutely vital, that we achieve that. So with that, Madam Chair, I would like to call on Cecile Perkel, who is going to go through some work that we did earlier, as you referenced, that again led us to the conclusion that Mincher simply has not given the state what we need, what was promised, and what was expected in terms of a system for determining eligibility for public programs. So thanks again, Madam Chair. We really appreciate your attention on this report.
Good afternoon. I'm Cecile Perkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor. And today we're going to provide you with an overview of this audit that we did, where we looked at how well the Mincher system determined eligibility for the public programs of the state, and the how well the Department of Human Services oversaw the eligibility decisions made by Mincher. So our audit focuses on DHS, not so much on Mincher, but on DHS, because it is DHS that has the responsibility to make sure that people that are in the state's public health care programs meet the eligibility requirements for those programs. Those programs are medical assistance, which is health care for low-income individuals, Minnesota Care, which is similar to medical assistance in some ways, but it's for people that are, whose incomes is above medical assistance, but still within a certain threshold. And then also for Children's Health Insurance Program, which is for children and pregnant mothers. We did this audit because we knew that DHS had struggled for many years to find processes and controls that were effective to ensure that people in their programs were eligible. We've been looking at this question for over 10 years and having audit reports that highlight various issues through that time period where we feel that DHS's oversight has been insufficient. Every year we do an audit of the state's compliance with federal program requirements, and of course medical assistance is the state's biggest federal program. And for the last 5 years, we've cited the Department of Human Services for not having sufficient internal controls to make sure that eligibility decisions are done well. For the last 2 years, we have concluded that they have not complied with federal eligibility requirements. So we went into this transition into MNsure knowing that DHS had struggled with this historically. And at the end of our audit last year, at the end of our federal compliance audit, we determined that DHS really wasn't well prepared for the transition into MNsure. Not only had they not adequately assessed how things could go wrong in their existing system and what controls they had in place, we didn't think that they had prepared well for what might happen in the MNsure environment and established that good controls were in place there too. So given that, and then added on to that, that MNsure had a rough rollout, we thought there's a pretty high risk that things may not go well, and we felt it was important for us to go in then and test how well eligibility determinations were made. So our primary objective was to determine whether DHS had ensured that people who enrolled in the state's public health care programs through MNsure met federal and state eligibility requirements for the program in which they were enrolled. And our conclusion was that they did not ensure that. They did not provide that assurance that people who enrolled in programs for which they were eligible. And our testing found many instances where the department did not comply with federal and state eligibility requirements for MA, for MinCare, and for CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. So before we get into some of the details about that, I do want to go tell you a little bit about how we did our work. We went into the state's medical payment system. For those who are familiar, I'm talking about MMIS. We went into MMIS, and we identified who had been enrolled in a public program through MNsure. We were able to identify coding that would identify those people that came in from October 1 through April 30th. That was our cutoff date, and I know that's getting to be almost a year ago now, but you got to start somewhere with your audit testing. So we went through April 30th, and we identified that there were 167,179 people who had enrolled in one of the state's public programs during that time period, and we were able to identify that population. So this included people that sat down at their kitchen table and went to the website and were able to navigate their way through the website and got enrolled. It also includes people that worked with DHS's help desk or MNsure's help desk or with navigators or brokers or assisters in order to enroll through the website. But it also includes people during that time period who filled out a paper application and sent it into DHS or sent it into MNsure, because ultimately that information was input by somebody into MNsure, and that information then was transferred into the state's payment system, into MMIS. What it did not include, what we did not test, was people who previous to October 1 already were in a public program. Those people did not come in through MNsure. That's a big group of people who already were in the state system. They were not included in our population. And we also did not include people who tried to enroll but were either denied enrollment, they were told you don't qualify, didn't include those people, or it included people who maybe got stuck in the system. I think we've all heard of that, they got stuck in MNsure and their enrollment didn't happen. So it didn't include that. These were just the people where they got enrolled in the public health care program. To make sure that we understood the environment we were getting into, we met with DHS, MNsure staff, Minute staff, the state's IT department. We went out to a variety of counties, metro counties, outstate counties, and had discussions with county workers about their experiences, too. We wanted to make sure that we had a good understanding of what kinds of problems were happening within the MNsure enrollment process and what things existed for a while but have been resolved, what things are they still dealing with. And we also wanted to talk with both DHS and the county workers about the training that they received and how well county workers were able to access the information in the MNSHR database. Ultimately, we went into that population of people that enrolled through MNSHR, and we selected a sample of 100 cases. Cases are kind of like households. And we broke that down by 60 of them were Minnesota medical assistance cases, 25 of them were Minnesota Care, 15 of them were Children's Health Insurance Program cases. Those 100 cases included 193 people because, of course, a household, it might be one person, it could be five people. So overall, we were looking at information related to 193 people. So we were able to go back into the MNSHR system and look at the information that these household representatives and these people, what information was provided. And what information did they see? We could see, you know, how their whole enrollment process happened, how they answered questions, what they provided in terms of an address or social security numbers or ages of children or, you know, all the information they provided was available to us. And then we took that information and using our knowledge of the eligibility requirements, we matched that information up with basically whatever else we could find. We got tax filing information from the Department of Revenue. We looked at wage and unemployment information from the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We also looked at other information that might exist at DHS or at the counties because maybe this household was new to the public program when MNSHR went up, but maybe a year ago they had been food stamp recipients, or maybe 3 years ago they had been on medical assistance. So those systems had some historical data that if we were able to go into those databases, or at the county there might have been a file about that household, we accessed that information too to make sure that we were using as much information as available to try to validate and verify the information that was provided as a basis for the eligibility decision. Where we could, when we identified a problem or we had a question and we could go back into that whole population of 167,000 people that enrolled through MNSHR, we then went out to the whole population to do an analysis. For example, we wanted to see how many people in that population are over age 65 and perhaps are on Medicare, and we wanted to quantify that. So where we had the opportunity to do that, we did also use that whole population. So we looked at this sample. In the end, we found that 17% of the people that we tested, so 17% of the 193 people that we examined, were actually not eligible for the public health care program that they were enrolled in on the state's system. Now, some of those people belonged in one of the other health care programs. So maybe they were enrolled in medical assistance, but as we looked at the analysis, maybe their income was too high for that, but they would have been eligible for Minnesota Care. Or maybe they were in the Children's Health Insurance Program, but because it was 60 days after the birth of a child, that person should have been in medical assistance. So it wasn't always that they were completely ineligible. Sometimes they were in the wrong program. We did find a few people, though, that should not have been receiving public, not have been participating in a public health care program. So I want to tell you a little bit about how the report is organized. We have finding one is kind of our overview finding where we talk about the overall results of the sample test. And then in findings 2, 3, and 4, we go to some other issues, but findings 5 through 10 go back into the results of the sample test and provide more detail about some of the specific exceptions that we found. And Mr. Hassing here is going to provide you with more information about those. So I'd like to turn it over now to Mike Hassing.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Michael Hassing. I am an audit director with the Financial Audit Division, and I oversaw the team of auditors that had to get into the MNSHR system on a very quick speed and a quick study and get into the details and the complexities of figuring out the eligibility and how this new system was working. These next few findings and slides that we'll go through, I think give you an example of some of the details and the complexities of the requirements, the regulations, the criteria, the documentation that exists in the system and that the people have to provide and that the Department of Human Services has to ensure that these people adhere to in order to facilitate the public eligibility for these programs. So in the first finding on page 7, just as an example, there were some cases where, and again, this is at the time of the audit, where certain of the information coming through that CURM eligibility model showed that the employer ID number was populating an income field. What we did is we had to go and validate to see how these people, the applicants, responded to those questions. Most people looked at that, recognized that it was not, you know, a correct amount that was in there. They correctly answered the question as no, and then that kicked back so they could provide some additional information to get the correct determination. But there were some people that just, as they were applying for that assistance, said yes to that information. And so the system, you know, again, would, based on those responses to some of those questions, they would have to go and look at additional information. Obviously, in this case here, the system did push the people out of medical assistance, so it correctly made that determination, but it allowed them to enroll in some other of the programs. In addition, as Cecile had mentioned, we had looked at some of the, where we could, did some data analysis on the population as a whole. And one of the things we were looking for was duplicate records, duplicate accounts, duplicate Social Security numbers, duplicate names or birth dates. And we did find there were cases within the system that had those. And we were told that in some cases, the people, because of the technology difficulties, some of the people maybe had initially started one account, established their account, but because of the problems with the technology, they kind of gave up, went back at a later time, and just started the process over. But that, in turn, allowed duplicate accounts to exist within the system. And so we found a number of duplicate accounts that were in the system. Some of those, again, the people at DHS had identified. In other cases, they had not. And so based on our sample, We brought those to their attention. Moving ahead to finding 5 on page 14, just again some of the other examples of some of the discrepancies that we found in making our eligibility determinations. Sometimes when a person applies for federal assistance, their information, once they input their information, it is supposed to be triggered through what they call the federal hub. And so the federal hub makes the determination of eligibility. And the federal hub is kind of a combination of information from the IRS, so tax information from the IRS, also tags into the Social Security Administration for Social Security numbers, looks at immigration status through the Department of Homeland Security. Based on that information that they ping against entered information from the applicants, the CURM module, the eligibility module within MNSURE, would provide a validation of that it was verified through the federal hub or not. But since we had not had any experience or exposure to the federal hub, we wanted to make our own determinations. And so again, that's why we kind of used some of the other information from the state's Department of Employment and Economic Development and the State Department of Revenue. One of the other issues with that is then if the federal hub would flag that the account needed additional verification, it would send a flag or a task out to the county workers that they would have to follow up, to gather additional information. And one of the regulations was that they were supposed to resolve all of those outstanding issues within 95 days of when they received notification. But unfortunately, through the technology of the system, and working at DHS, they were not able to get the notifications provided to the people, either timely or not at all. And so again, this window of verification made it very difficult for the counties to know which cases they needed to follow up on and find additional information. So we made an assessment that going towards the end of our audit period, we were looking for any cases that were open and outstanding, unresolved, for 95 days from the time that these people applied through the end of June of 2014. And as we show in finding 5, We show that we had a number of cases that were open beyond that 95-day exception period. Finding 6 on page 17, again, we had a number of cases where we found that enrollees' incomes exceeded the program limits. Again, through the ACA, a lot of the program limits for the medical assistance program had changed. People submitted their information. And DHS accepted the information based on the attested information of the applicants for the public programs. But again, we went back and validated and re-verified that information with our own independent sources the best we could, and the primary source of that was through the Department of Employment and Economic Development, employment information, unemployment information, and we found that there were a number of individuals receiving assistance that had incomes that exceeded those limits, both at the time they originally applied and then after the enrollment period had begun. And again, the recipients of the public assistance programs are supposed to report changes in their income, changes in their family makeup and their family dynamics whenever those occur, because it could have an impact on eligibility. Finding 7 on page 21 is an example specifically of that, of household size and family relationships. And again, as I just said, DHS does accept the attested information that is included on the application for the applicants of public programs. And even in the DHS verification plan that they have submitted and was approved by the federal government, they said that they were not going to do additional reviews of family makeup size and family relationships. However, when we were looking at individual cases, as part of our sample, we noticed that there were some that just had illogical relationships, that parents were reported as children of their children, just by the dates of the birth and how they were listed in the system, or where we saw that spouses or children were reported as other relatives, where in fact they really were the children or they were the spouse, a married spouse of an applicant. And so again, based on those classifications, if it was done correctly, we found that these people would not have been eligible for those public programs. In finding 8 on page 23 of the report, we talked about enrollees that were in Minnesota Care but really should have been in medical assistance. So again, they got placed into the wrong program based on the information that they had provided in their application. So again, we tested a number of individuals based on what they had initially input into the eligibility system when they were applying for their assistance, and found just again a number of cases that did not meet the requirements of that program. Even though they were getting public assistance, we counted it as an error because they were not into the correct program that they should have been. We also found, to a lesser extent, but found some other examples of recipients of the federal programs. We found Minnesota Care recipients who were also enrolled in Medicare. And so this is one of those areas where we did some further data analytics. We're able to try to look at that population of all those people that were receiving Minnesota Care but were age 65 or older. And just because they were over 65 doesn't mean that they were not eligible for Medicare, but typically that is the case. We also found that there were some women that were still enrolled in the CHIP program, 60 days postpartum. And again, as a requirement of the program, at 60 days there's supposed to be a redetermination of the program eligibility, and they should have been placed into a different program at that point in time. But we found still that there were people, again, at the time we did our audit work and verification, that had not been reassigned to the correct program. So those were some of the examples of some of the individual case files and case situations that we were looking at. In addition, as Cecile had mentioned earlier as well, we looked at and discussed with county workers at I think we went to 12 different counties, some of those in the metro area and some of them in greater Minnesota. But we just wanted to hear. We wanted to listen to what they had to say about how things were functioning and what information were they really getting from DHS. And one of the things that we heard repeatedly was that they feel that the county workers did not feel that they were well trained. Part of that was that the development of the system went up right up to implementation date, and so the total functionality just wasn't really available to be trained on. Others of that, there was poor communication between the Department of Human Services and the county workers. They talked about the complexities and of the exceptions in some of the cases. The cases that a lot of them referred to as happy cases, where it was pretty straightforward, seemed to flow through the system okay, but it was a lot of the cases that the county people deal with are more extreme, difficult cases that they have to deal with that have a lot of exceptions to the standard rules. So again, the county workers did express a lot of frustration with the training and the lack of time. In addition, they didn't have the full functionality of the system. County workers were not able to close cases. County workers were not able to add information when their clients would come to the county offices with, I've got a change in income, I've got a change in my family size, we had a baby. They just were not able to make those changes to the system that would have an impact on their eligibility as well. Just a couple other items that we included in the report. Finding 2 on page 9 talked about the interface of activity from the Minsure system to MMIS at DHS. And we found that this transfer of information, which happened throughout the day, that it was not, that data was not accurately secured as it was transferring between the two systems. And that, again, that there really wasn't an assurance provided that the complete information was moved from the Minsure system to the MMIS system. We would have hoped that, you know, there would have been a real diligent reconciliation that was made upon every transmission of that data to ensure that everything that was recorded as a input on the Minsure side ended up being loaded into MMIS so that the Department of Human Services could make payments. And then we also noted in the report on finding 11 that DHS was charging incorrect premium amounts to people who had enrolled in Minnesota Care. And again, this is at the time of our audit. For the period of January through March of 2014, the department was not billing any of these people that were receiving assistance. And Minnesota Care does require a fee based on a sliding fee scale. For the period April through June of 2014, the department started to make some billings. However, we found a lot of the billings that were being sent had errors. They were billing either at a wrong rate or billing people that really weren't in the program or just incorrect billing process. And then in addition, we found that the department was not terminating people for non-payment of these MinCare premiums, which again is part of state statute. So again, we had a lot of specific examples of the details of case files that we went through, and that resulted in the report and resulted in the conclusion that we reached on that report.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Members, I know we do have a couple questions. We are going to let the counties come forward and then DHS, and we'll save questions for the end when we have everybody at the table. So with that, we have some folks from the counties, Heidi Welsh, who's the Director of Income Maintenance from Olmsted County, and Marty Fishbach, Director of Economic and Employee Assistance from Dakota County. So I'm not sure which one of you wants to start first, but if you want to introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Marty Fishbach from Dakota County, Director of Employment and Economic Assistance.
I'm Heidi Welsh from Olmsted County, and I'm the Director of Family Support and Assistance.
I'm going to go first. We certainly experienced much of what the legislative auditor just talked about, and I thought what might help give our experience is to talk a little bit about the volume and how the volume affects us, as well as particularly with the lack of functionality. So that's kind of what I'm going to focus on. So to start out with volume, there's about 1.1 million public health care cases in Minnesota. These are cases that are in medical assistants and legacy systems in MinSure and Minnesota Care. So it's the whole ball of wax of healthcare cases. And people, not healthcare cases, people. The of those cases right now, about 60% are in the legacy system. So we don't have even half of the full amount of cases in the new system. And because of the lack of functionality, obviously we have concerns about adding more cases without adding that functionality. So one of the things I thought might be helpful is to talk a little bit about the world of county case management and the life cycle of a case. We have cases that are enrolled. We update changes, so household member changes, job changes, address changes, that sort of thing. We have renewals where there's a re-enrollment process that confirms or changes eligibility. We close cases. That's kind of the life cycle of a case. In order to manage these cases, and particularly a high volume of cases, we need tools such as supervisory oversight of cases, system automated notifications of missing items, late items, or reminders of tasks coming up, reports that can be used to identify trends, volume of workload status, those kinds of things to let us know whether or not we're in compliance with timeline regulations. We need the ability to move large numbers of cases at one time. We need to be able to organize cases in groups to be able to manage by task or manage by worker or prioritize items of higher importance. So we need quite a bit of functionality in order to manage volume. Of these life cycle and management tools, because we have such limited functionality in the system, the strongest function actually is getting additional cases. So once we get the cases, the ability to manage them is severely lacking. We, as we gain more and more cases, then it exacerbates this problem. And because there's so little functionality, escalating problems to the state creates bottlenecks there in order to manage all the competing priorities. Our current functionality is limited to adding new cases, entering paper applications if they don't go the online route, changing addresses within a county, adding a baby, and we have just recently been released some limited situations where we can close a case. We have identified about 69 items that need to be addressed in order for us to have a functioning case management system, and most of those would help us do things that I talked about before as far as the life cycle of the case and just managing a high volume of cases. The state has identified about 24 to be addressed in 2015, which would be very helpful, but it's not going to be everything we need. The functionality issues, as I understand it, are there's probably about four categories of issues. One is that the functionality exists in the platform, but it hasn't been released yet. Some functionality has been implemented, but it needs to be fixed. Some functionality doesn't exist and needs to be built. And there's some existing functionality where we need a streamlined process. We, for example, when we add a baby, it takes us about 45 minutes. And in the legacy system that we had, that was about a five-minute process. The impacts include poor customer service for the people we serve, lots of complexity, and the efficiencies that we had hoped to gain in a modern system have been outweighed by the difficulties we've had. I do want to mention, though, that the efficiencies, such as having somebody enter online and perhaps get enrolled just with the information they entered, that's a really exciting part of having a modern system, and that's what we need to get to, which is something our legacy systems didn't provide. So that part is exciting to see the potential. I'm going to turn it over to Heidi.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Just a little bit more about case management. I wanted to draw a picture for you of what case management looked like before we had MNsure, which was people would apply on paper, or sometimes they would send us, we have a little bit of an electronic system, but we'd be able to process everything within 30 days. County workers could handle any sort of issue that came up in an MA case. So it wasn't immediate. Everybody had to wait a little bit of time for us to process, but we could handle it all within about 30 days. Now we've got a system where some people go in and their case is relatively straightforward and they do get an immediate response, and they're immediately enrolled, and it's electronic, and nobody's involved, no workers have to get involved, and that part is the easy part. But for those cases that don't go through cleanly, it's a really long and complicated wait. So I just wanted to draw that picture for you, that it's not that every case is running into troubles, but when a case does run into trouble, then it's a really deep problem, because we don't have the functionality, as Marty mentioned, to be able to make any changes. And when we do have workarounds, for instance, Marty talked about the add a newborn, you know, we're coming out with manual workarounds, but they're very complicated. So, for example, in order to add a newborn, there's 56 pages of instructions about what our workers have to work through in order to do that, or 59 pages to enter a paper application. So it's complicated when we actually, when we can't handle, when there's some change to the case. And then I wanted to give you just rough numbers. It's very hard in the system to be able to tell you how many cases have an issue. But we did try to track in Olmsted County and found that every week we make 63 contacts to the state. We spend about 21 hours on the phone with the state trying to resolve cases. We submit 40 help desk tickets on average, and we're submitting somewhere between 25 and 40 change in circumstances. So what that means is they're piling up over time, because we're not able, that means all those changes go to the state and wait in a queue to be fixed on that case. And over the course of 3 months, between November of 2014 and 2015, this is a rough estimate, so there's not strong science behind this, but our rough estimate based on that number of changes is that about 1,000 of Olmsted County's 6,000 cases had some kind of issue that we couldn't resolve at a county level, and they had to go to the state to resolve. Some of those issues are small, and they really didn't affect eligibility, but some of them are huge. And so let me just give you then, finally, just a sort of a listing of the kinds of issues that we're talking about that customers are still waiting to have resolved. A couple of examples of where consumers, they've incorrectly been made eligible for MA, and the legislative auditor talked about that, but we still have many of those cases where consumers they're not eligible. For one reason or another, the technology didn't work right, and now they're sitting in a queue waiting for that to be resolved. I have cases where the consumer moved out of state, and we can't close the case still. So I have an example of a case of a woman who was a 17-year-old who moved to Texas. We reported the change and tried to close the case in August. And as of the 9th of February, it still was open. In the meantime, that consumer tried to open a case through Texas ACA and couldn't do it because she's got an open case here. We have clients where there's been 12-month delays to customer access. They've been waiting for 12 months to get onto MA because there's something wrong with the case and they're in one of these queues. So, 5-month delay, consumers who didn't have coverage because there's an interface problem with MMIS, or bills that didn't get paid correctly because the baby's birth date was incorrect. So the list goes on and on, but I just wanted to give you a little flavor of what does this look like to the customer walking in the door. It's very frustrating to counties because we want to do good customer service. We really want to serve clients well, and we just can't do it without this kind of functionality. So, thank you.
Thank you so much both for being here and taking the time. Really appreciate it. And if you're able to stick around for questions, we will bring DHS forward now. And then after their presentation, we will go to questions from members. But just as DHS is coming forward, I just wanted to let members know, I thought that this would be helpful because as we've had a lot of mentor discussions over the last couple of years, I had the chance to go last summer and spend some time in my county sitting with social workers trying to understand some of the things that we had heard about in theory but didn't really know how it was working at the county level and some of these frustrations. It was incredibly eye-opening, and so was hoping that today getting some of these tangible ideas of what do these problems really look like on a day-to-day basis, and then also to hear from DHS and obviously some of the challenges that they know about from the OLA and how those are being addressed. And I will point members out the fact that in your packets you should have this, I'm sure will be referenced by the commissioner here. It's DHS's kind of response and plan to address some of the challenges pointed out by the OLA. So with that, thank you so much, Commissioner Jessen, for taking the time to be here. It's very much appreciated. So if you want, not sure if you have a particular testimony you want to go through or address some of what's been brought up, and then we'll go to questions after that.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and with me here is Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson. I thought I'd just say a few words on our response to the OLA report, and then Mr. Johnson may say a few words about what's on the chart, but mostly we just want to answer your questions. I think, as you all know, and I've said this before, and I think that what the county said reinforces this, that the success of the Minsure IT system is just really critical to DHS and our county partners, because it's not just a portal to our health insurance system. It really is what we believe will be in the long term the IT platform for integrating all of our public programs. So the goal is to get this platform right, and that's why it's so important for us to get it right so that we can add cash and food and have one place and one system for signing up people for public programs. I really want to thank the OLA for their good work on this audit. And, I think that this report, which I think was issued last November, is actually even more understandable after the OLA report that was issued. Was that only last week? When we were all here. Report, and I agree with the overall assessment of the Minsure report, which was issued last week, which talks about the real challenges of the rollout over its first year. And this review provides concrete examples of what that has meant for people, for our county partners, and for those of us at DHS. It shows just how challenging this rollout has been. I think the good news is, Madam Chair and members, that while these audit findings, I think, are very serious, and as I said, reflect the challenges of that first year, the year that probably should have been 1 year and three of rolling out a new IT system, I would say that the IT system is in a different and better place today than it was in April when this audit period ended. That the eligibility determinations that are made by the Minsure IT system today are improved, and that's because a number of the issues, but not all, of the issues that have been raised in the auditor's report have been addressed, including the multiple types of verifications with wage data and the correction of defects such as duplicate accounts and some of those affecting income calculation, the disenrollment of Medicare beneficiaries from Minnesota Care. And we have closed a lot of those cases, though not all, because it continues to be a challenge. And Mr. Johnson may walk through a few of the things in the chart that shows what we have addressed since last April and where we're in progress and kind of what our plan is on those. So I'll let him do that. But I do want to just, add a few words to those by our county partners. And this is, while the system is in a better place, I think, as far as making those eligibility determinations, it's doing a much better job than a year or even last April. I think the real challenge that faces us, and it's not something that we're going to solve in 9 months or a year, but it's critical for us to solve, is really the back-end work. So after someone comes in through the system and they're found to be eligible, let's say, for a public program, and the question then is, how are we able to manage those cases? To make those income changes, the household changes, the like, but, to make sure that we can close the cases we need to close quickly without, cumbersome processes. All of these are changes that really are critical for our ability and the county's ability to handle these cases. And, of course, we see those at DHS as well, because as our county partners said, when the cases get tough, they're escalated to us, and there are a number of things we're still doing at DHS, life changes, change of events, some of the case closures, because they are so challenging. So we do believe there's been made progress, but that there a lot more progress has to be made. As the county said, they see, and we agree, 69 issues that really need to be addressed. The governing IT governing group has identified an initial set that are priorities that I think we in the counties agree should be the priorities that we need to get a good start on in 2015. But I also want to be clear that while, our county colleagues said, we do see the potential and the light when we see those cases that work well and that go through, and that potential is exciting. We also just see a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done to make that potential a reality for all of these cases. But moving our health care programs to this new system is critical. The status quo in our legacy systems is not an option for us, as I think I've said before. Yet I will be the first to say that until we get better functionality in the new system, we are not kind of converting those the majority of cases that are on our legacy MACSIS system. So we need to see improvement. We are seeing it step by step, but it is there should be one place and one system for signing up public program enrollees. It's hard work, but we need to get there. And I thank the OLA for their ideas and guidance along the way. Ms. Chuck, is there anything you want to add referring to the chart?
Madam Chair, Chuck Johnson, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Human Services. Just to orient you to the chart a little bit, I won't go through it in detail, but the column on the left are the audit findings. There were 11 findings in the audit. What we tried to do here is to show in the middle column which of those items are things that where a fix has already been made, and the column on the right, those things where we still have work in progress. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of things because I think that they're important. If you look down the middle column where we have things that have been fixed, and you see some of these right there in the first box, you'll see a number of the issues that are really going to that front end of the system, and is when someone goes into the system, are they getting through and are they going to correct eligibility determination? You'll see a number of those were fixed early in 2014. Those are the improvements that were really made early last year, as Commissioner Jessen has said and as the county folks referenced in terms of what's working in the system. A lot of getting those things right. You can see that Mr. Hassing talked about the duplicate payments, and we did identify those. We collected back about twice, actually, what the auditor had identified because we went looked at it over a longer period there. What you'll also see, and this kind of pops up when you get down to item number three, which is really about the counties, and item number four, which is really about closing cases. As Ms. Welch, I think, identified most notably, one of the big challenges counties still have and we still have with the system is making those changes after someone is enrolled. When they their income changes, they add household members, they remove household members. We've developed procedures. We're working on those internally at the department. We've moved some of the procedures out to counties so they can start doing this work. We haven't gotten all of those procedures out to counties. But fundamentally, That's a way to work within the technology we have now. We are also working going forward as part of our improvements in 2015 to make it easier to enter those changes. So it's not a 45-minute process. It is a 5-minute process. And we're working really hard to try to put the counties in a position to be successful because this is one of the key things from a customer service standpoint, from a program integrity standpoint, that is one of the key challenges. And as we're scoping and looking at our plan for 2015 for development using the additional funds that were provided by the federal government, this is one of the three issues that we've put at the very top of the priority list. We've already started scoping sessions on it. We brought counties into those scoping sessions. We at DHS understand the counties are the front-end users of the system. They need to be involved as we're working on the improvements to the system, and we've embedded them with us to do that work. And we think that's important going forward as well. Madam Chair, I think I'll just conclude with that. The most part of the document speaks for itself, but clearly we can answer questions on that if people have them.
Okay, thank you so much. And I don't know if the folks from the counties want to come forward, just so you're nearby for any questions or comments that you might have for some of the questions. And the OLA is obviously there also. Any one of you who needs to weigh in on any of the questions, you're welcome to. all the perspectives are very helpful here. So members, with that, we will open it up to questions. I do have one right off the bat that's probably for the department. But I guess just one of the issues, kind of the broad-spanning issues, is these things of these unclosed cases. And as we look forward in terms of, you know, being able to make sure that we're delivering service to the people that need it as quickly as possible, would you, the department, say that you feel counties have a clear path in which to escalate and resolve issues of concern as they pertain to some of the operational integrity of these cases? Do you feel like counties have that path to the department in terms of figuring out how they can most quickly resolve some of these issues as were highlighted earlier?
Madam Chair, I think that we have a process in place. I think that process has been overwhelmed at times because the counties have been putting so many issues through to our staff that we're not able to resolve them all as quickly as we need to. And part of what we're trying to work on to address that is we're doing a lot of work, a lot of management of cases, particularly change in circumstances and other aspects of that, at the department using our staff that really the county should be doing. We have to get the counties in a position to be able to do that piece of the work so that we can provide the support role, we can do the escalation, we can do the help desk tickets and process those through more quickly. And we're working now with the counties to try to organize how we take these big chunks of work, some of which are bigger than they should be because the system, we have to work around the system rather than be able to work effectively through it, and figure out who can take on which pieces in which time periods so that we can best use the collective resources that we have, and thinking about it really as being resources we have, the resources the counties have, and how we work collectively on that, and particularly with the larger counties that have a capacity to work with us in that way, we see as really where we can get the most benefit.
Okay, and just a follow-up to that, is there a, would you say, a foreseeable future at this point, at which point a lot of this won't have to funnel to the department, where counties will have the capability to manage some of these more complicated cases? Is there any type of guideline you could give us to say, you know, within this amount of time, or it's in the foreseeable future, we're not there yet, or is it still kind of a far-off dream that we're not quite sure how we're going to get there yet?
Madam Chair, let me take a first shot at answering that. And in answering that, I want to be very careful because we understand the challenge, because the best way that we can make sure that we're not having to do it, and we can give this to work to the county, is to have that new functionality so that we really have the system fixed so it's easy to make change of circumstances, and it doesn't take 45 minutes to add a newborn. With the additional federal funds that we have received, we are working with our colleagues at Minute and Minsure to kind of scope out and say, okay, how long would it take to get that functionality in place? So that we, and the counties are involved in those work groups with us, so that we can collectively be very realistic about what the answer to that question is. I want to be very leery of saying, and frankly, and I said this before, kind of even at the last Minsure board meeting when they said, well, here are the 17 things we're going to do in 2015, I was like, I don't think we're going to get through all parts of all of those in 2015. We need to be very careful about what we can do and work with the county so that we're realistic, so that they're able to make plans and we're able to make plans. I think we'll be in a much better position to answer that question for each of these major things like change of circumstances in the next 2 or 3 weeks when we've started working through some of these, scoping out. But I want to be, I don't want to give a date that I'm going to regret having said. Chuck, anything you want to add or correct to that? Okay.
And I will say, Commissioner Justin, I appreciated your candidness in that Minsure board meeting on just trying to highlight the importance of priorities and realism in setting expectations both for the public and the legislature. A lot of leadership there and very much appreciated. I heard that board meeting, and I think that something that sometimes has been lacking is realizing that there is a long list of fixes needed, but priority setting is really going to be the way to get through that list in a methodical fashion. The one question that I have on the chart that we have here, number 4, it says that since August 1st of 2014, DHS has closed more than 5,700 cases. I guess my question is, how many are remaining? And then my other part of the question that pertains to that box there is that the first bullet point, it says the new system will correctly close cases if a life change makes a person ineligible. I'm wondering the term new system, what is that referring to? What new system?
Madam Chair, the new system references to the MNsure system, the MNsure eligibility system. We use different terminology to talk about what it is. To your second question, we had been keeping up with closing cases. We right now have a little over 3,000 that are closed cases that are backed up. We're working on those. Part of the reason for that is because as we were working on the renewals process, which is running through all cases on public programs have to have their eligibility renewed once a year, had a big lump of those in January, obviously, because of all the people that applied and all the Minnesota Care cases renew in January. We aren't able to make any changes to those cases while they're in the renewal process because the renewal process itself updates the case with new information, new verification for determining eligibility going forward. So some closures came in that we had to wait until we worked through the renewal process before we could execute against the closure.
Okay. And I just have one final question on this, and then we'll continue to move to other members. We heard the issue of the help desk, these tickets that come to you that are the complicated cases that counties can no longer remedy the situation. I am wondering, is there a process for prioritizing those help desk ticket items? My understanding is there's probably thousands of them. And I'm just wondering, as they come in, is there a means by which the department prioritizes based on high need or critical situations, whether it maybe is a waivered program or somebody, you know, disability? Could you explain how that's done and how those are prioritized?
Madam Chair, I don't know all of the priorities and exactly how they're structured. There is a prioritization process. I know closure of cases, particularly cases that have moved out of state, or cases that have requested to be closed are a priority from a closure perspective. We have prioritized any case where someone's coverage there's an immediate need for coverage and they're having trouble getting into coverage because of some kind of a critical health situation. We have immediately prioritized those and fixed them whenever those have come through. We are also working on the waiver cases with the counties, an issue that came up a couple of weeks ago, and figuring out what the priority for those is. There aren't a lot of them, but again, it's a need for people to be able to get into the kind of services they need for people with disabilities. So we do have a priority system. We're working through those categories and trying to identify, particularly with the counties, what are the real critical ones from their perspective. But as I said, also, those closures and those people that have immediate need for access to health care are the ones that we've been working at the highest priority.
Okay. Members, I'll just encourage everyone, obviously, with MNsure, we talk both the QHP side, the private plans, and the public programs, and the focus of today's conversation, obviously, is all around the public program side. So if we could focus our questions to those. The first person is Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the questions I just had in terms of just the process of the auditor was it appeared to me that you had access in auditing cases to information like Department of Revenue tax forms and things like that wouldn't typically be available to a county case manager or a state agency person processing the case. And that's appropriate in an audit situation, but I just want to verify that may have been, you know, part of your quality assessment.
Mr. Hathi.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did obtain access for audit purposes to the Department of Revenue tax forms. One of the things that we noticed in law was that there was a part of the state law that did allow for a data sharing agreement between the Department of Human Services and the Department of Revenue related to Minnesota Care. But we were not aware that similar language existed for the medical assistance program. But that is something that we secured for the audit based on our methodology.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the other thing I just want to say, and I know you've had to make all kinds of tough choices and prioritization as you've gone along on this, I just want to say thank you for inviting the counties to the table and engaging them in that process, because I think we sometimes forget that they're the main users of a system, and I appreciate that. And more importantly, I want to say thank you for not bringing all the legacy system people into this system when it's still stumbling, because I think we would have had a lot more challenges, and I know that that's created tensions to have to run two systems and train new employees on two systems, and you know, this whole process has asked everybody to step up with their A game and more. And I just want to publicly say thank you to everyone who's been involved in this, because it has asked for more than anyone had expected, and sometimes delivered a lot less than we'd hoped. So thank you for making choices, even if they were difficult.
Madam Chair, if I could just echo that and compliment you and the committee for having the counties here. You know, what we can bring to you is an audit report that is based on our experience months ago. And that was certainly, with our report last week. And I think a lot of people naturally say, well, you know, you're talking about the past. Well, I think having the people that have come just from the front lines today in their county offices to tell you how life is like, the challenges that are still there. In fact, I said to a number of people that from last week's testimony, and we participated in 10 hours of testimony about our report, the most disturbing thing to me was not what we said. It was what the commissioner or the executive director of Minsure said about the challenges that remain and where we are today in February, after all the time and money we've spent to build this system, and what I think was echoed by Commissioner Jessen. The past was not good, but frankly, where we sit today is not either.
Question from Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First thing, I'm not too sure who's best to clarify this, if it's from the auditor's side or from the Commissioner Jensen's side, is I keep on hearing some things being somewhat interchanged to me when I hear, first of all, reference to public programs, and then I hear reference to the Minsure medical programs. And want to try to get a, when we're talking about public programs, that, and we're talking about the eligibility now, are we just talking about the medical side, or are we also talking about all public programs that are being administered?
Commissioner Jessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I'm sorry if I didn't speak as precisely as I could have. What the Minsure IT system is doing now for our public program enrollees is it is where people who are newly enrolling go and determine whether or not they're eligible for either MA or Minnesota Care. And so it is that new IT platform that we hope that we are built, that if we that what we our plan for it is to ultimately be an integrated IT system that serves all of our programs. So that's why it's so important for us to get this right, because now we have a number of different IT systems. It's, you know, there's PRISM, there's Maxis, there's MMIS, there's MC, we have a number of them. And so and they're all legacy systems, and they're all old. And what we're trying to do here is build a new system so that ultimately, after we get it to work right for healthcare, which is a challenge, it can be a platform where we can add some almost like other modules. So it can also be a place where someone can go and put in their information, and if they want, find out, am I eligible for SNAP? Am I eligible for a cash program? Am I eligible for the healthcare program? Am I eligible for child care? That ultimately will be better for people. It will be much better and more efficient for our county workers. And that's where I think, if you hear the counties or me say, sometimes when we see these systems working and the cases go through, we see the light at the end of the tunnel and we realize how worth it it will be. But it is much, much more of a struggle to get there, I think, than any of us had anticipated.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I'm understanding, this is the first layer of what's coming down the road. But when we're taking a look at where we are, I've heard that we've heard, had some of these eligibility issues coming up for almost 10 years now. If I was understanding what was being mentioned in the auditor's report, when I hear that, what kind of progress have we made? You know, are we still dealing with some of those same issues as 10 years ago? Are we making any? How quantifiable is the headway that we're making?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, I'll try and answer that, understanding that I haven't been here all of those 10 years. But certainly I think that there's been a need that the department has seen and the counties have seen to replace these legacy systems, which you know, which are old, which we're not going to be able to maintain many years into the future, where, you know, people who are going to school today aren't even trained in the kind of techniques they need to be able to repair and work on and change these systems. So we need to move to a new system. I think as the OLA noted in his report, the state tried this in probably starting about 10 years ago, I believe, with the health match system. That didn't work. A lot of state money was put in to try and have kind of an online eligibility decision that failed. I wasn't here, but you know, certainly I think that the sense of that made us realize how important it was to get this right this time. So I think during that time, including a lot of time before I was here, I think the OLA and their reports are pointing out here are problems in the eligibility determinations, particularly with Minnesota Care. And I think first the state was like, let's make Health Match address those, and now let's make sure that we build our MnSure system to address those concerns. I think the good news is, as we were saying, we do feel that we're in a much better place as far as the ability to make the correct eligibility determinations than we were a year ago or even last April when the OLA's report was finished. But what we see are the major problems moving forward is the case management, the back end of that system that we need more work on.
And Representative Fisher.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Last part is, as we're coming into this, is it sounds like you folks have identified a large number of things that will be getting addressed here, and I appreciate what you folks are doing and involving the people along those lines. But as you start looking at time frames and also where the potential barriers are, how much of that is things that are under your control and how much are things under others' control that, whether it's something that we need to be doing more of, et cetera. How much of that, in other words, what are the different responsibilities and what do we need to start doing differently to help make this smoother?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, thank you for that question, because a lot of this is not precisely in the purview just of the Department of Human Services. And that's why, if you all will recall my testimony even last week when we were talking about the OLA's review on overall the first year and MnSure, you know, I emphasized what I saw as importance of this IT governance structure that includes, from my perspective, and I think this is consistent with what the OLA recommended, that this needs to be in law, and from my perspective, we need to have representatives not just of MnSure the business, but also of DHS, of the counties, and of Minute, and that from my perspective, we need, you know, the public programs need to have and that means both DHS and the counties kind of an overarching role in that IT governance. So I do think that is, and as you look at different options for governance for MnSure, I think that is one thing I would ask you all to look closely at, which I think is consistent with the OLA's recommendation as well.
Thank you for that. And I was just to add to your initial question, Representative Fisher, about kind of the problems that have plagued our programs for 10 years and eligibility determinations. That is certainly a fact. This is not new to MnSure. In the short time that I've been here, I've been very interested in the process of program integrity and eligibility verification, and I've talked with Mr. Nobles about this at length, trying to learn from the mistakes of Health Match, talking to the counties, and so certainly it can't be argued that this is new to MnSure. I think what can be frustrating as we get to this point, and as you listen to committee tapes from 2 years ago when this was coming into existence, I think what's hard to swallow at this point is that at that point, when we had all this federal money coming down, MnSure was kind of sold as the be-all, end-all of all of these problems that have been plaguing our programs for so long. And really, many of the problems go to the complicated nature of how you are eligible for these programs. Many of us have been trying for a long time to simplify some of those processes, but the problem is so many of those root issues haven't been addressed. I think that we were told that all of this federal money coming with the ACA would be the answer to all of our problems. Many of us highly doubted that, and we continue to wrestle with a lot of the same problems that have plagued us all along and will be the curse of any IT system until we get to some of that stuff. So that's just my own two cents. And Commissioner Jess and I, we've talked about that at length, and I know you agree with at least part of that and some of those problems that have plagued us for decades now. So just to shed some light on Representative Fisher's question also. So next question, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've got some number questions, but building off of what the chair said in some of this discussion, I'm glad that you're moving forward, but in the moving forward, it'd be nice to know when the new system will not include counties doing paper submissions. In your number six fix, it was supposed to be deployed February 16th, was it? And then I noticed you're going forward, you have where you fixed all identified cases in number 10, and you're looking at the renewal process to tie in some other fixes. What happens about ones you haven't identified? Are you going to not go back and look for those? And if anyone doesn't renew, is there any backward look to recapture dollars like you did in number one?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'm going to answer your first question. I'm going to ask Mr. Johnson to come up and answer some of the more detailed questions, if that's okay. As far as when the counties will no longer have to do paper applications, just a bit of history on that. I mean, historically, the counties have been the ones to process paper applications before we even started down the MNSURE venture. You know, we took this on at the department last December when there was such a, not last December, December 2013, when people were struggling to make it through the website. And we did that at the department. It was much more complicated, and it's still not easy, but it was even more complicated and cumbersome then, and we trained our folks and we just pushed through to do that ourselves. And then as part of, once we were able to kind of get instructions, and as part of what Mr. Johnson was explaining is kind of overall, here's a lot of this work, what makes sense for the counties to do, what can the department do, and how does that change as we go forward. We shifted the paper applications starting in, I think it was October or November, to the counties as we were taking on kind of the initial renewals and doing more of the change in circumstance. So I hope that gives you some context. Overall, the long term is as the system gets better, more and more people should be able to go through it. So there should not be as many paper applications as certainly as there was a year ago. And I think we're starting to see that, though since the counties are doing the paper applications, they'll have a better sense of that. There's some people who are always going to be more comfortable with paper, and some people that have problems getting through the identity proofing on the website that are going to be better served by a paper application. But certainly what we hope, whoever's doing it, is that there are a lot fewer paper applications in the future as the system continues to improve. With that, I'll maybe ask Mr. Johnson to answer some of the others.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, on number six, the item that was listed, that was part of the February 16th release, and so that fix did go in. I'll say, because we're only a week out, that we're always checking to see in production if it's working the way it's supposed to, and I can get an update on that. I don't have it here as to whether we've identified any problems with that fix. On your question on number 10, these cases, we are identifying the cases and fixing them when we identify them. These are particular kind of cases that are hard to systematically identify because they tend to be somewhat anomalous in how they're popping up, is my understanding of the ones that are referenced here. We continue to do that, and we continue to identify them and go back when we find ones where there has been a problem. But this is really something where the IT fix needs to be in place for us to manage that process of what happens with these cases, particularly the pregnant women cases and the timeline around eligibility.
Representative Quam.
Okay, thank you on that. And now into the dollar question. I was looking at 7, 9, and 11. It'd be nice to have an idea of approximate total dollar impacts in those areas, especially since you noted where you had recaptured nearly $88 million in aired payments. These other three areas, it'd be nice to know what the costs are, and then when you have that, who covers the cost of these errors? Is it going to be the taxpayer? Is some of it the burden pushed back on the consumer who was misdirected by a system that didn't work? I mean, I'm just trying to understand how big is this, and then what are the ramifications for the different people involved?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam. Number seven, we wouldn't have a dollar amount on there. I think the issues that were identified there by the auditor were based on verifying against sources that are not required. We're not required to verify against under current law. So there isn't a gap there from our perspective fiscally. I don't have numbers as far as if we know on 9 or 11 exactly what the dollar amounts are, but I would say this. Under current state law, when we make a capitation payment to a managed care organization based on the eligibility run that we have for a given month, once we've made that payment, we don't have a way to recover it back. So it's based on us really getting it right at the time that we're making the eligibility determination and putting that into the capitation run for that particular month. So to your question, these errors do end up, to the extent we have people who shouldn't be on the program but are, or to the extent we have people who may have gotten extra months of eligibility, maybe issues that are costing the state additional money under the medical assistance program.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not surprised by that. It's somewhat disappointing, but it's very disappointing when there are different eligibilities, and we're told, well, the law doesn't allow us to, you know, check and take care and fix those. I invite the department and maybe the auditor personnel to let me know how we need to fix the law so we actually care if we're, eligible for these programs, because, frankly, if we have it just for the eligible people, then we'll have more money for all these other programs that at the end of the budget period, we sit down and there's $11 million or whatever it is left over, and we've got dozens of good programs, but we don't have extra money. Well, if we didn't pay ineligible, then we might have, you know, because one item was $88 million. Well, isn't that, DHS discovered, and it's this, their document, DHS recovered 87, oh, I'm sorry, okay, 87,000. I feel a little bit better then, but, it would be nice to know what was happening, get controls. It's not just this system, but every system has been promised as this will take care of it, and it'll be all good. But if we don't have in the law to where they can even, they said we can't by law go check that out and verify the eligibility, well, then it's on us to write a law that allows the system to have checks and balances that actually do take care of it, because there's a need. Let's get it to people that need it, and then if we have extra money, we can put it to the next group of people that really need it, because we're never at a shortage that way. So it'd be nice to have that information, and if you do get actual dollars for 7, 9, and 11, that would be a good idea for sizing. Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my question is for Commissioner Justin. Thanks for coming back up, Commissioner Justin. Commissioner Justin, in reviewing the last OLA report as well as the one on eligibility that we are now reviewing, one of the things that we have come upon is the difficult technical task of deploying this system and making it functional for Minnesotans, which obviously we have failed at. Trying to get that right has taken a lot of time, and a lot of money has been brought to light through the auditor's report as well as through other reporting. One of the things that I looked at was an application to the federal government for additional funds for technical expertise and help with the with MNsure. We received, as I recall, $34 million for additional assistance. Do you recall, Commissioner, what the entire ask for that request was?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, you know, I don't, I think that would probably be a question that kind of MNsure may be able to be in a better place to answer.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Jessen. As I recall, and I forgot to bring it down from my desk, but it was a multiple of what you actually received. And in reviewing the requests piece by piece of what you said you needed from the federal government in order to fix MNsure and the technical aspects of this, from additional monies for IT, personnel, supplies, on and on and on and on and on to make this thing right, it was surprising to me the scope of the request and the comparison to what you were actually receiving with that request. I am concerned that we have folks, Minnesotans trying to deal with MNsure at the site level. We also have hardworking state employees and county employees trying to make this thing right and trying to help these people through the process. And we have a technical system which is not fixable with the resources of people and money that we have currently deployed. I am concerned that there are not the systems in place within DHS, within the counties, to accurately and adequately communicate what those needs are up the chain, and that people are suffering because they are not getting they're not getting the service they need because the technical fixes are not in place, because the work's not being done, because we don't have the people and dollars and technical expertise deployed. So where we've seen where we are, we said, oh, it's getting better, we can pay for ourselves, we're getting there, we're almost there. But what assurances do you have for Minnesotans that actually that the dollars that we currently have will get us to the next enrollment period coming out? You know, that the light at the end of the tunnel, is that a light or is it a train?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, you said a number of things. Let me try and address them. I mean, you said that this obvious system obviously failed, and I certainly said I agreed with the overall assessment of the legislative auditor from the first about the first year, and that the failures outweighed the benefits, but there were benefits. So I wouldn't just I don't agree with that overall assessment. I do think things are improving. As far as the dollars, I'm not, you know, familiar on a on a detailed basis with the request that was made to the federal government for the grants, but I do know that what we have received, because is not just there's the $34 million, but there's also an additional dollars coming from on the Medicaid side, so that we end up getting to about $85 million overall. And Mr. Johnson probably can kind of give you more of the breakdown of how we get there, but that's because if you kind of pull down the societal funds, there's also a federal match. There's a smaller state, but there's kind of additional federal Medicaid dollars as well. So we do receive more funding, actually. So my concern, frankly, Madam Chair, Representative Dean, is not so much that we don't have the dollars to be able to fix this over the longer term. I do, you know, sometimes worry you know, you can have dollars to spend. We've got to have people. We've got to hire them. We've got to have things in place. And I know that our colleagues at Minute are heading that up. I think they're here if you have other questions about that. But I know they're working hard on that. I guess I would just want to be clearer, Madam Chair, Representative Dean, when you said you're saying we're almost there, that I am not saying that. I'm very clearly not saying that. I'm saying that we've made progress since this report, certainly since that first year, that I do see, as I think I said earlier, like when the counties see, when you see these cases go through and it works right, you say, there's a light there, that it's worth doing, because we need that to happen for all of our cases and not just in healthcare. So I don't think it's a train, but sometimes that light is fleeting, and we have a lot of hard work, and that work is not all going to get done, certainly, I don't believe, by the next open enrollment. So I don't want to be in any way misleading you, but I think it's work that we have to do, because, as I said, on the public program IT side, you know, status quo isn't the option, and we do think we're making progress.
Question from Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner. And I think Representative Dean took one of my questions from me in regards to the federal funds and whether or not that would be enough to do what needs to be done to really get them, these systems talking and working and being functional in a way that we are covering the people who need to be covered. And so it's kind of like when I listened to the reports from you and from the county and the OIA report and the urgency that we put upon this to happen in the last session, and there was definitely some benefits of having the urgency, you know, to say that, you know, we don't want people with pre-existing conditions to not be covered, and that we want children, you know, I am so grateful that my children who graduated out of college are not working, but they could be under my health care coverage, you know. And I know, so there has been some benefits from ensuring that we are covering people on the front end, they're not using the emergency room on the back end. And the troubling part is that, you know, there has been 10 years and probably more of dysfunctional with the systems and bringing on more different systems that are not talking to each other or not working collectively together. And here we are with a administrative system, which is another IT system, to do the work that needs to be done for MedSure. And then trying to find a way that we can have it to collaborate and talk to the out of date systems, which are the legacy system, and so we are at this kind of like this crossroad, right? In my mind, that we are looking at real people's lives who may be in limbo, who's waiting, who may have a newborn child, who don't have the coverage, you know, and we're waiting for some functionality to happen in a more cohesive way, so that we are delivering the best service that we want, you know, needs to be delivered. And so, you know, I heard you say that, you know, $85 million is what was coming from the from the federal government, and hopefully some of that will support the IT pieces that needs to take place. I know we gave a little money at the state level, which was like a drop in the bucket, which was not enough to do the work that needed to be done. And so we have work. We need to hire people, as you just stated. So hopefully we'll get more people working on this from the 87 counties in a way that's going to be sufficient and more functional. And so I guess, you know, I don't really have a question now, because that question around the federal funding was my question, as to whether or not it will be enough. Would it be enough? And if not, I guess my question is, if you can state clearly to us, you know, what is needed for the state, for the counties, to do what they need to do and be more functional, what would that be? And what could we as a legislative body do to help make that happen?
Commissioner Justin.
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, if I may first address something you said that talked about the lives in limbo, and, you know, and I do understand that we need to focus on people who were not treated as well by the system, and you know, the counties and DHS, we're struggling to make sure that we get them the help they need. There have also been a lot of lives that have been made better by the Affordable Care Act, and people who have, and we have so many more people with health insurance today in Minnesota, and so we cannot forget that as we try and fix the things we need to fix. I need to say that. And what is enough? I mean, I do think that there's kind of the dollars that we need to really make the kind of development fixes that to make the system work better. For an example, the, you know, to make sure that we can close cases that in a way that doesn't take all this time and effort. that we can that make change in circumstances happen, you know, in a routine way, so it doesn't take 45 minutes to add a household member. I mean, those are like developmental fixes, so we need the money for that, and that is really what this collective $85 million hopefully will help us do. But that doesn't mean that it's all the money we're ever going to need, because there will be kind of just ongoing kind of maintenance and, you know, IT fixes every year for the system. They're going to be the changes to the system, some of which we already have funding for and have set aside, to move beyond just health care to being able to make it an integrated human service system and adding the cash and the eligibility and the food eligibility. So I'm not saying, oh, this is it. This is all we'll ever need. And I would also, but I think this will help us with those really critical development pieces that we talked about, those 17 things that we really got to get done in the next couple of years. For that, more detail on that, I would really just actually refer the questions to my colleagues at Minutes, because they just have a lot more expertise in that.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to end with this, you know, because for so often, I know, you know, in my little time that I've been here, too, I came in and we was in a huge deficit, you know, and there was a lot of conversation that we have to just do more with less, and it's kind of like impossible to expect more to be done with less, to be done with less. And we can try, but we can sometimes say that we are not as effective as we need to do when we don't fund things the way they need to be funded. And I could say we find ourselves in a little bit of a havoc here because of that happening over just the years of just not having enough funds and support to make it happen. You want to respond to that? Or
Commissioner Justin, did you want to respond, or we can move to the next question?
I think we can move to the next question.
Okay. Sounds good. And in the interest of time, I appreciate that, and thank you for the comments, Representative Moran. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Justin, I guess a lot of the questions revolve around assurances, and I guess that would be my question, is what assurance can you give us that the miniature operations around public programs are going to improve? Before you answer that, though, let me just qualify that, because actually something Mr. Noble said is that, you know, that look back was scary, but what's even more scary is where we are today. And Ms. Welch gives an example of trying to add an individual and looking at a 56-page how to do that. To me, I can't imagine someone sitting down and creating that and the common sense kick in and say, we can't have a 56-page response to this. I really appreciated this effort here, but something in the, you know, in the business world, they specifically manufacturing, they talk about Six Sigma operations, and that's about towards zero defects. And one of the main things in that is when you're working on a goal, you have to have a finite goal attached to it, and you have to have an end date. So one of the things that struck me here, though, in all of these in-process things of how we were correcting it was DHS is reviewing, DHS is working, DHS plans to train, working to test, we expect, DHS is working, we're reviewing. And in none of those in-process things do we say, we will have by December of 2015 every employee trained. We will have the ability to correct any of these eligibility requirements by June 30th of 2015. And that's when all these questions of assurances, that's really what we're asking for. We realize we spent a lot of money to get to this point, but I think most of us accept the fact that we're going to be spending a lot of money going forward to correct it. So when we ask for insurances, that's really where I'm going to, and my suggestion would be to maybe rework this and give us some concrete items that we can really look to and say, we're with you on this then, if you can tell us these things.
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative, let me just take a couple of those. I'll try and make sure I get them all. As far as the, you know, are things going to improve? I think actually if you look at this chart, and this is just about the eligibility determinations, this shows, because this is kind of, we're taking it from the end of April when the OLI's audit, you know, identified these problems, some of which we've known about, and say, okay, here are things we fixed. Okay, those are things that we've improved, and here are things we're still working on. You know, so I think this is just one snapshot in one area that shows we have improved, things are getting better. And the 56-page you know, set of instructions, you know, they're hard to follow. And boy, I'm glad you appreciate also the way the trouble it took our staff to like put them together. The answer to that is having a system that adds a newborn, you know, when you just kind of put it in one screen and it kind of clicks to everything else instead of having to have an elaborate workaround. And that's what these large instructions are. They're elaborate workarounds because the system isn't doing what it was supposed to do to begin with. And having that, having the system fixed and these development dollars to do that is really critical. As far as end dates, so much of fixing this is depending upon the IT. I hope that after we get through scoping kind of these original, you know, these 17 things that we've said we need to make sure that we get to work on that are our priorities for 2015, and after our work with the counties and our colleagues at Minute, we'll be able to say, and here's our target date for being able to get this done so that we can easily, you know, have the system fixed and we'll be able to easily enter a change in income. And here's the date we think that'll happen. But I must say, because they are so dependent upon the IT world, until we have those discussions, I'm not going to make a commitment. I think that one of the things the OLA's report says very clearly about kind of what happened with Minsure, it was, you know, overpromised and underdelivered, I think were the OLA's words. And I want to make sure that I'm not doing that, because both we all need to be able to count on realistic time frames and realistic commitments, and that's at least from the Department of Human Services, that's what we want to do. And I think my county colleagues are with me on that. But when we do, as soon as we do have those timelines, we will share those.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kelly.
And Commissioner, I appreciate that. But regarding just the history of where we've been, I don't think we have that luxury of that time to say we can be that ambiguous with a goal. I would just suggest that we make those goals, and if we don't make them, then you're back here saying this is what's happening, we'll get there. I just think we don't have the luxury of the time due to where even Mr. Noble suggests, not the look back, it's where we are today is pretty scary.
We have Representative Mulry next, and members, we are going to adjourn at 4:30. We have a couple more people on the list, so if we could keep questions and answers as succinct as possible, just try to get to everyone, that would be great. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. Well, the second one might take a little longer to answer. First one was, it concerned me that you're not going in any way after when there's a clear overpayment or something to the client. Why are we not in any way going back to get that money? Can we legally? Is there some reason we can't? If it's a clear one, and I agree we should not be going into a lot of time to get it back, but I would think we'd make some effort, but it was said that we don't make any effort. Could you explain that real quickly somehow?
Commissioner Jessen.
Madam Chair, Representative Mulry. As many of you all know, in a lot of our programs, if someone gets benefits they're not entitled to, we do go after them. That is our natural kind of thing that we routinely do. We do that with SNAP. We do that with you know, a lot of our cash benefits. I think what Mr. Johnson was alluding to is where someone is found eligible, kind of if it was later a mistake, and therefore for medical assistance, and we pay the health plan to cover that person. Going to the health plan and saying, well, that was a mistake, give us the money back. That's a different situation than going after an individual in our other programs. And that's what we have done, though, in some of these cases where we have seen folks that we think, perhaps it's a case that should be closed, but we haven't been able to close it yet. We'll move them into our fee-for-service system so that we're not making those capitation payments. So we have been trying to address that where we can. Anything you want to add to that, Chuck? Okay.
Okay. And my second
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My second question was, obviously when you have an audit you can go into it a lot more than you're supposed to, and so you go get the tax records, you go get everything, but we've had a lot of instances before where legislators came up with the so-called great idea to make people go through a lot of hoops before determining eligibility, and my question is for Mr. Johnson. How do you determine at what point, in other words, and another thing about, and I don't know the answer, if the application is solely based on the last year's income tax return or not, but I know that people in this situation, their income fluctuates a lot and can go up and down, and the income tax return for the last income tax return may have nothing to do with their present income. It could be higher or lower. How do you determine how much time to put into that before it isn't worthwhile to us to make sure that we got the exact amount?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I think that's actually exactly the right question, is what's that balance between how much effort you put into the verification and the tracking versus the trade-off of ensuring that you're giving people some adequate access into the services that they have a need for. The eligibility under the new rules with the Affordable Care Act is largely based on the income from the prior year, but there are other checks that are done as part of that. And the way the system, and the system actually does do this at the front end quite well, is when people enter in their income data, the system then goes out and looks at electronic records, federal records, state records, the deed records, and then comes back and identifies, and there's a standard called reasonable compatibility as to whether the information that the person put into the system seems reasonably compatible with what we found on these electronic sources. And if not, then we have to follow up and go and get additional verification for them to demonstrate why the information they put into the system is correct. And so that's the process and how it works now. And that's a pretty good balance because of the ability to use electronic sources as a way to ping. And if it comes back and says it looks good, then we don't have to have an additional process and can do it through the system. But to the point that, you know, the auditor is raising, those electronic systems haven't always worked very well in the past. That was the Minnesota Care finding that Mr. Nobles referred to over a decade. It is working pretty well in the new system for the new applicants, but we still have challenges around when changes are made. And the renewals process is working pretty well, but we have some issues we need to work on there as well.
Thank you.
Okay, and one final question, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, this is kind of for you. I mean, a lot of the same questions have been asked here throughout the hearing, kind of in different ways. I think, well, let me just say, I think it's pretty clear from a lot of our questions that we want you and we want the commissioner and we want the counties to tell us what tools you need so that we can make this all as smooth and successful as possible. I've heard that in a lot of the questions that have been asked here. I wanted to ask you, you were kind of getting it in the weeds here, but we've had 10 years, according to Mr. Nobles and his team, with concerns about eligibility in DHS. And I just, surely we don't wait till the OLA investigates it to recheck and circle back and do quality control on this. And I just wanted you to describe, if you would, just really high level, what DHS does to do its own audit, to check its own math to make sure that the eligibility is as close as we can get. I mean, that was, I think you were in the weeds on it just now, but I just want to know, is there a system? Is there a special unit? Who's doing it? How often? How does that work?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. So I think at one level there are the tools and controls around the work that's done at the caseworker level, which includes what can be done through an IT system, whether it's a legacy system or the new system, and some of what I just talked about in Representative Mullery's question. And then there's also the training and monitoring of what county workers are doing as part of their work. And that's normally done through a quality control process. And it differs a little bit by program. The system that's in place for medical assistance is called PERM audits, Payment and Eligibility Review. It's a federal mandated system. It's a system, a process by which we go out and are required to go out every year. It's on a three-year cycle, so we do over a three-year cycle, and audit eligibility results on cases, determine what's been done right, what hasn't been done right, report that to the federal government, correct the cases where we find problems, and then also use that information to make systems changes, to try to address where we're seeing systemic kind of problems happen, do additional training for counties, additional guidance for counties, other work that might be needed to help support ensuring that we are not repeating those errors going forward. Our PERM audit rate was 5.8% in the last year it was measured, which was 2012. National average was 5.7, so we're right about at the national average for our PERM rate. The federal government with PERM has basically suspended those audits with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and are experimenting with three different pilots of new ways that they might do these audits going forward. We've been participating in those. We don't yet know the results of that or what process they may put in going forward. But the point of all that is there's a required process that we go through to do our own audits to try to identify where we're seeing issues in eligibility across all of our programs, but that's particularly the process for Medicaid.
And then,
Madam Representative Liebling.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Johnson, I assume that we, the legislators, have access to those results and that we can see, get the ongoing result of those audits and not have to wait for the auditor to come out and do this kind of thing.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, that's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, members. Well, thank you so much. Thank you to Department of Human Services, the counties, and the legislative auditor for your time today. I know we could spend probably a great deal more time and a lot more questions, but with limited time, thank you so much for the presentation. And members, with that, we are adjourned.